version of hair, but I'm stuck in the bed that I made. So I'm lying. If you keep breathing close, yeah, you stay real close. I'll reach you.
Gone from the Gentle Battleground by Professor Fangirl. Read by Just Got One. You are gone, and despair impersonates a street. E.E. Cummings. The dream's so vivid, he can smell the cordite. He's crouched behind a rock on a very high ridge. The stony ground falls away before him precipitously, abrupt as the side of a building. The bottom of the valley is too far down to see, unknowable, but its name comes into his head, the Coringall. What is he doing in the Coringall? It's an American outpost, Restrepo. It's called Restrepo, and the name is so sad it hurts his heart. Why is the name so sad? There are no British in the Coringall. Wait, there was one. There was a British casualty, but he wasn't a soldier, was he? There shouldn't be Brits in the Coringall, but they need medics, so John's here. That's why he's here, though he doesn't belong here. It's not his time. Not his place. The young Americans are fighting, shooting, yelling to each other, though John can't hear them. He can't hear anything, just distorted underwater echoes. The soldiers are dirty and unkempt and gorgeous in their strength and their stupid courage. They turn to and away from each other, passing ammo, shifting positions, changing lines of fire. It looks like they're dancing. Some of them are laughing in the weird glee of the fight, but John can't move. He can't quite breathe. It's the altitude. This is the wrong place and the wrong time. The wrongness of it warps the light and makes things move too quickly, with the unnaturally sharp, unnaturally fast motion of Hollywood war scenes, shot with an overcranked camera. There are too many flying details. He can't follow anything. Gunfire stitches up the ridge, a long, smooth seam that runs up and over the soldier to his left. The blood blows out his chest in a red mist, like the smoke of a snuffed candle. He falls forward in slow motion, arms spread wide. John still can't move. He feels sideswiped. Another soldier pushes him down. Catch him! Fix him! But he can't feel his fingers, and without feeling in his fingers, he can't find the injuries. He can't diagnose without feeling. He still can't see because the light is harsh and blinding up here so close to the sun. It's a yellow halide glare, throwing lens flares, lighting the dust until the air seems solid. When it clears, all the colors are oversaturated, and mostly he sees blood. Red, red blood on the yellow rocks. Technicolor. Blood against the rock going black. Now he can feel his hands, because they're wet, slick, and red, but he still can't find the injury. He yells, "Helmet! Get his helmet!" at the kid next to him, and when it's unstrapped and pried loose, he sees a terrible, crushing injury to the side of the skull, black curls matted with blood. The head rolls limply, and the boy with his pale, pale, unlined face is looking at nothing with blank blue eyes. When John comes to, he's crouched half out of his chair, gripping the edge of the desk. His desk. In his office. In the clinic. He can still smell smoke. He fumbles into his chair and tries to bring himself back to the present. "Scan your body," his therapist says. "Feel where you are, how you're sitting, your chair. Touch the things around you to remind you where and when you are." So he looks at the room, runs his hand over the desk, letting the smooth surface brush away the feel of stone and blood. He stands, still shaking, limps to the window. The glass is cold against his forehead. The world looks slaty and dull, wet and cold, 30 feet above sea level. You could not get farther from the heat or the height of the Coringall. But he's still sweating, and he still feels blinded. All he can see are the blank sky blue eyes, the terrible, measureless distance in them. His shoulder hurts. He is very, very tired. Even when he turns from the window, he sees the world as through a pane of heavy glass. He lives at a quiet remove. The only things that really happen happen inside his head. London is gray, mundane, ephemeral, but his thoughts are vivid. They have weight and substance. Sometimes sand, blood, and gunfire. sometimes the arc of a body falling to earth. Where did that dream come from, he wonders. He surfed in the desert, not the mountains, not the Corangal Valley, not Restrepo. Then he sees the magazine still open on his desk and he remembers. Tim Hetherington, the British photographer killed in a mortar attack in Misrata. He made a movie about Restrepo, the tip of the American spear, the deadliest place in Afghanistan, named after PFC Juan Restrepo, a very young platoon medic killed in action. So that's where John was, replacing both the Englishman and the medic in the tricky displacement of dreams. He sits and looks at the article again. This journalist, Sebastian Younger, prolific, accomplished, ridiculously handsome, journalist as action figure. This Younger did his homework. He spent 14 months at Restrepo and knows the details, knows the things John knows. Men reek of ammonia, he writes, because their fat is gone and their bodies are burning muscle. Levels of cortisol actually drop in trained soldiers during combat. In the Corangal, you can see a gunshot, but not have time to move before it hits you. There is literally no safe place in the Corangal Valley. Men have been shot while asleep in their barracks tents. The desert was safer, John thinks. He himself saw more dead Afghanis than Westerners. Maybe he should be grateful for that. He's not. Most of Younger's story is about how young men bond in war. Some of them straight up hate each other, but they die for each other. And once you have experienced a bond like that, everything else looks pathetic and uninteresting. John remembers this, how profoundly they depended on each other. When a man had your back, it wasn't a metaphor. He'd be literally pressed against your back, scanning the ridges behind you, covering you. You'd lean into each other, prop each other up. What they really miss, Younger says, is being necessary. To be necessary. He cannot forget the urgency of that connection, the intensity of it, the violence. As both doctor and soldier, he knew too much blood-soaked intimacy with other men. Soldier and doctor both get inside other men's bodies in bad, bloody ways. In war, violence and care could look so much like each other, an uncanny, horrific resemblance. Sometimes he feared he'd forget the difference. In war, love could look like violence, and violence like love. Perhaps it was the very brutality of those ties that made their losses so hard to mourn. At Restrepo, the young soldiers sealed their bonds by beating each other, coming and going, as initiation and farewell. In 2nd Platoon, Younger says, you got beat on your birthday, you got beat before you left the platoon, on leave, say, and you got beat when you got back. John imagines cleaning them up, unable to tell the difference between the injuries of the battlefield or the barracks, those of enmity or fraternity. But he understands it. There's an intimacy to violence. It inspires, perversely or not, an absolute trust. This is how soldiers bond in war. They beat each other, but they die for each other. There's no one in his life that John would die for now. Sarah pokes her head around the door. All done? She asks. Ready to go? He's stuck for a moment. Oh, yeah, right. Lecture. Sure. Yes. They've been dating again, if you can call it that, for 2 weeks now. She's taking a class in literary history. She brings him along. You're all soldiering in medicine, she says. You need a little culture. He gives her his arm automatically as they leave the clinic. He hails the taxi. He opens the door. He tips the driver. This is what you do when you accompany a woman. These are the things the man does, and he's mannerly enough to do them with grace. But he was a different companion once. Once upon a time, manners were beside the point. Once, he was pushed into taxis by himself to follow leads. Once, he slipped behind doors to cover suspects. Was a time he carried a gun. Once, things happened to him. Once, he made things happen. But now, they only happen in his head. Sarah cares for him. He knows she does. She's strong, she's smart, she's professional and accomplished. She's peaceful, never at war with herself or him or anyone. She's not obsessive or cruel or presumptuous. She's not dangerous or mad or challenging in the least. She's not overwhelming. She's not too much. She's not enough. And the thought makes him hate himself on her behalf. The lecture hall's not crowded, though it seems to ring with voices. They take seats on an aisle toward the front. John dislikes these flip-down seats. They always make him feel as if he's being folded. He shakes open the little program, a single sheet folded in thirds, reads the title, The pastoral elegy in the Epic of Gilgamesh. It makes no sense to him. It sounds like medical terminology must sound to the layman. He looks at the list of quotes on the page, long chunks of verse he doesn't read, doesn't see. In his mind, a fly crawls through the fingers of a beautiful Afghani boy whose face is caked with sand. He closes his eyes, shakes the image from his head, slips back into focus, his fingers on the wrist of his beautiful fallen friend whose face is veiled in blood. The lecturer steps to the podium. No, not the lecturer. Too young. A graduate student introducing the lecturer, giving the historical background. He fumbles his notes. His coat's too big. John isn't listening. Babylonian literature began with writing in cuneiform, he says. Wedge-shaped marks on mud tablets. John couldn't pay attention if he tried. The people around him seemed to be. They seemed to be absorbing information. They seemed to be thinking. But that's not thinking. John's seen thinking. He's seen focus so total it seemed to shift the gravity of the room. He's seen Sherlock thinking, eyes a far pale blue, the washed clear color of thought itself. John was the only one with the courage to venture the distances in those eyes. The difference between that thinking and this is the difference between shooting a bullet and throwing it. Here between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, in the cradle of civilization, modern-day Iraq. John looks up. The word brings the war to him instantly. That word is war. Iraq. The crack of a gunshot. Without Iraq, no Afghanistan. Or maybe it's the other way around. Doesn't make any difference. It's all war. His war. And it doesn't end. Sarah leans toward him. He thinks she'll ask if he's all right, if the reminder of the war has troubled him. Where do you think he got that coat? She asks. His father or his grandfather? She smiles. She has no idea. She has no idea about any of it. She has no idea that he is still grieving. It's been 3 years. Many people don't grieve for spouses that long, or parents, much less mad flatmates with pretensions to genius. It wasn't a pretense, he corrects himself angrily. It was real. She has no idea that Sherlock was wonderful. She saw him as just about everyone else did. A bastard. A brilliant bastard, maybe, but still a bastard. Obsessive, cruel, presumptuous, dangerous. The one night she met him was the worst night of her life, she says. John can't blame her. Of course he can't. But he can't explain to her either. Explain to her the focus that came sweeping into those eyes like a hawk's flight in the sky. How it landed on John with the delight of a solution. I have it, John. And spiked his chest with talons of glee. How thrilling it was to run after him. The glamour of him, his long legs, his long coat, his headlong rushing intensity. The same intensity whether chasing a suspect or an idea, through a street or through his mind. That's how an evening at Baker Street could be as exciting as a car chase, watching Sherlock pace and mutter, his words spooling out along the course of his thought. Following that thought as it dashed along was like running a path through woods until the countryside cleared and you were standing on a hill with the whole landscape laid out like a map at your feet, and the way you'd wandered etched clear and true and inevitable. There's no way he could explain to her what it was like to follow this, what it was like to be taken in by this man, to be welcomed by him, to be needed by him, to need him, in turn, the way you need to have the lights on. Ready to be dragged by him anywhere, through any night, through any street. Handcuffed to Sherlock with more than just metal. The memory of it stabs him with yearning. The heart-struck suspense of excitement, the drop in the belly when threat came close, the soaring relief when they won. These are memories that live in his body, and now when he feels them, he knows what they were. He sees the sexual arc, excitement, tension, release. Sherlock was right, he thinks. He really was an idiot. An idiot not to understand what I wanted from you. So simple not to know love. Afraid of it. Dumb with fear. I've only learned it now in the safety of your absence. Because you are not here. You will never be here. You are years away. 3 years gone. And there's no desert like that distance. It's dried me up. It's desiccated me. The obstinate days, the stubborn hope, the argument of time. How do I do this, Sherlock? How do I get through this? When, God help me, when does the morning end? How do I make it stop? How do I do this? The student in the bad suit has left the stage, and now a woman steps up, smiling at the light applause. A muted suit, a chunky necklace, shoulder-length salt-and-pepper hair, reading glasses on a beaded chain about her neck. Respected female lecturer, direct from Central Casting. She smiles. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming out for such an esoteric subject. John drifts back into his head. When a professor says esoteric, it's all over. The screen lights up behind her with a picture of an ancient bas-relief, a strange image of a crowned man dangling a lion from each outstretched arm. PowerPoint. God help us. He glances at Sarah, who is actually taking notes. The lecturer puts her glasses on. How do men grieve? She begins. John snaps too. He can't have heard that right. Perhaps he's still in his head, where everything is more real, where that question lives. How do men grieve for each other? For all the questions raised by the Epic of Gilgamesh, this is one of the deepest, the loneliest, and perhaps for us the most important. In the modern world, there are too few cultural spaces for this to happen, too few models for how men can mourn the loss of male friends. The loss of lovers has the whole history of lamentation and elegy. The loss of parents, the language of memorial and remembrance. The loss of children, the wrenching despair of women's grief. Indeed, women do most of the work of mourning in our culture, and it seems they always have. And yet, the oldest song of grief in the world is the grief of the king in the Epic of Gilgamesh, the grief of Gilgamesh for his beloved friend Enkidu. It's 5,000 years old. It's the earliest piece of narrative writing we have. It's the story of one man so loving another that he follows him to the underworld to learn and defeat the secret of death. A long verse quote appears on the screen. She reads it. God, how he hates it when they read their slides as if everyone in the audience is blind or illiterate. And the words sink through him like very old stones. I'll cry now, citizens of Uruk, and you will finally hear what no one else has ever had the nerve to say in sorrow. I was family and friend to Enkidu, and I shall fill the woodlands where we stalked with loud, sad sobs today. I loved you, Sherlock. Every person in London should know that I loved you. I put it in my stories, after all. John's sudden identification with the words catches him off guard. He's startled by the reflection of his own loneliness and isolation in the voice of this poet, so far lost in time and space. And those in Eridu who loved your fame and say your name aloud, they too weep tears today, and all in days to come, even those who knew you not, all may weep tears some day for your sad lot. Someday London will know it was a lie, because it was. Someday they'll know the truth of it, and they'll cry for you the way I do. He catches himself and feels a little silly. Look at him playing at poems. John Watson is not a literary man. Books, yes, he loves books, thrillers and mysteries and others with good strong plots that pull you along. But literature, its symbols, its metaphors, its layers of meaning, not so much. He doesn't get it. But now he hears a voice from an ancient tongue from the time when Iraq wasn't a battleground, but the fertile crescent of the world, when the desert was a garden, and it takes just a little shift to hear his grief in those words. You were the axe upon my belt, and the bow in my weak hand, the sword within my sheath, the shield that covered me in battle, my happiest robe, the finest clothes I ever wore, the ones that made me look best in the eyes of the world. You made me strong, Sherlock. You gave me something to do. You gave me someone to be. Before you, I was invisible, incapable. Nothing happened to me until you came along. And then everything happened to me. And suddenly I existed. I was real. Suddenly people saw me in your reflected light, saw me because of you. John stares into his lap, teeth clenched. He feels horribly exposed. He takes a breath, shakes his head, tries to laugh at himself. Getting moony over a poem, for God's sake, seeing himself in metaphors. Silly, sentimental, ridiculous. How Sherlock would scoff. But there's a bittersweet pleasure in it, as if his pain was looking for a shape to take, a better form than nightmares, and these lines are a lattice on which it can hang. And in this way, the next line unmans him. Why? Because you were my brother, and you died. When we met and fought and loved, we went up on mountains high to where we dared to capture God's own strength in one great beast and then to cut its throat. Gilgamesh and Enkidu fought when they first met, bonding like soldiers bond. Then they loved each other, pushed each other, became better together. Then they fought the Bull of Heaven, and Enkidu had to die. You are my brother, and you died. We met and fought and loved, but we didn't kill the beast. The beast killed you. Suddenly, he hates this woman, hates her utterly and completely. How dare she talk about a man's grief? Presume to know the meaning of men's love for each other. How dare she quote a poem 5,000 years dead and half a world away, as if it had anything to say about the loss he feels, here and now? He doesn't have time for this shit. He doesn't belong here. He leans to Sarah, whispers, "Sorry, you know, I'm not up for this at the moment. I'm going, if that's okay. I'll call you." He ignores the query in her eyes, pretends not to hear her say, "Will I see you later?" For once, he is not mannerly. He slips past her, out the back, the page of quotes crushed in his hand. The streets smell caustic, macadam and car exhaust. The fog has fallen and condensed to rain and weeps down the facades of the buildings. It drips from his hair and beads on his face. He wipes it off, angrily. He starts walking toward Baker Street. He's limping. His leg hurts. The pain is only in his head, he knows, but since the only real things are in his head, he has to limp. He can't stop hearing the verses, can't help reading the damp and wrinkled page. The leaves of the trees and the paths you loved in the forest grow dark. Night itself murmurs, and so too does the day. All the eyes of the city that once saw your kind face begin to weep. "Pastoral elegy," the lecturer said. "The natural world mourns the loss of the beloved." Not here, he thinks. Here, it's the streets of London that grieve their lost detective. Let the roads we walk together flood themselves with tears. Let the beasts we hunted cry out for this. The lion and the leopard, the tiger and the panther, let their strength be put into their tears. He turns up Waterloo toward the bridge. The Thames looks tarnished, empty, desolate in the rain, one tug trawling sluggishly up the north bank. "I should have loved you sooner," he thinks. "There would have been a time for such a word." After learning how to pause his heart, Gilgamesh created the same image in the face of a river. John watches the water pass and lose itself in the distant city. There was a time for him, a place for him, but it is not here. He shrugs his field jacket up higher, heart aching with anger and loss and a sneaking blood-sweet hunger that will not go away. The joyful will stoop with sorrow, and when you have gone to the earth, I will wander through the wilderness in the skin of a lion. It's 3 miles to Baker Street, so by the time he gets there, he's soaked and shivering. At one point, he thought he'd have to leave his flat because of the memories lurking in every room, every hall, every slant of light, but he couldn't do it. Whenever he walked out the door, he felt unfocused and lost, as if reality still lived, only lived, in the place they'd shared. He climbs the stairs in a half-lit gloom. He puts his key to the lock, and the door drifts inward. The lock's been jimmied. The start and the thrill of adrenaline don't shake him, they ground him. Everything's thrown into sharp relief, and at last the world outside his head is real, perfectly, urgently, fearfully real. He steps to the side, tips the door open, scans around the corner of the frame. The room looks empty, but it feels off, as if the gravity of the place has shifted. "John." Sherlock's voice comes from the gloom, very low, very weary. "John, it's me." He's standing by the mantel, canted toward the window, a slim, dark silhouette against the rain. John feels absolutely calm, absolutely still, absolutely rooted. He notes everything minutely, how the rain on the window casts trickling shadows on Sherlock's face, how the jacket, once tailored to a hair's breadth, hangs loose on him, how his hair's too long and covers his cheekbones, how his eyes are shadowed, how his face is drawn. John steps in, pulls the door closed, looks at his hand on the knob. Where have you been?" he asks, and the question sounds so mundane, so banal, he wants to laugh. "I was cleaning up, after Moriarty. He's dead, has been, dead. The rest of them are now, too. Sherlock's voice is thready and broken. It keeps faltering. You're safe now. He seems to be losing his place. We're safe now. John walks to the center of the room as steadily as if he were wearing battle gear. His limp is utterly gone. Sherlock. He hasn't spoken that name aloud in so long that his voice catches on it. What? Sherlock? What? The fuck? When? Every question starts, stops, dies on his lips because in the end, there's only one. Why? And this time, it's his voice that breaks. Sherlock doesn't really answer the question. You asked me to stop, he says. You asked me to stop being dead. I've stopped. It's over. The realization is like an icicle to the gut. John is sick with it. When did I ask you that? Though of course he knows full well. At my gravestone. When you touched my gravestone. Fury floods through John, wrenching and incandescent. Finally he can move. You were there? 3 steps to the mantel. He grabs Sherlock's lapels violently, jerks him close, yells into his face. You were there? You let me stand there and cut my fucking heart out? You let me walk away? You... He throws him up against the wall, fists against his chest. You brutal fucking cunt! With each word, he slams Sherlock against the wall. You heartless, shitting bastard! He's screaming now, and it rings through the house, and he doesn't care. I loved you, you fuck! I loved you! There is an intimacy to rage. It's the second most powerful emotion, the flip side and mirror of love. Any object of that much passion means a very great deal. Sometimes you hate because you care, and sometimes you fight because you love. And the experience of fighting can bind you to another in blood-deep ways. And at this moment, John is a fighter. I could kill you, he snarls quietly. Perhaps there's no other way to express it than to break this beautiful body once and for all. I was a soldier. I killed people. I could snap your fucking neck. But there is no violence that can get me close enough to you. He was a doctor. He had bad days. 3 years of bad days. But this, oh, this isn't one of them. He yanks Sherlock's mouth towards him, and he nearly bites it, nearly savages him, but at the last moment, something inside John crumples. For Sherlock's lips are trembling, and his eyes are stricken, and he's whispering, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. His mouth is soft, and when John's mouth moves against it, he tastes tears. I loved you, he weeps into that mouth, that soft mouth. I love you. That pale, beautiful face, that smell of weariness and smoke, this body he has loved at the distance of arms and years. This body, quivering and unsteady. With a little start, he unwraps his fists from Sherlock's jacket, and the pale, shaking figure begins to slide down the wall. John's physician's instincts kick into high gear. He moves under Sherlock's shoulder, wraps an arm around his whip-thin waist, half-carries him to the sofa. He throws the suit jacket off his shoulders and runs searching fingers over his head, his neck, his wiry arms, looking for injuries. Battlefield doctor suddenly thrusts to the fore. He rucks the tailored shirt up, tries to unbutton it, whispers, fuck it, under his breath, and rips it open so that the buttons scatter. He's frightened. His heart is heavy with the dread of what he'll find. As if this were, indeed, the battlefield, and this another lovely young soldier with shrapnel in his heart. He slips an arm around Sherlock, lifts him forward, efficiently strips the shirt off his arms. He cringes when he sees the bruises, but he hides it well. No soldier needs to see the medic cringe. I'm all right, John, Sherlock murmurs. I'm perfectly all right. Shut it, John snaps, but softly. There are bruises up his right side, variegated storm clouds in purple and black, yellowed at the edges. There's an ill-stitched cut beneath his left collarbone, an abrasion on that shoulder, fully scabbed. Oh, Sherlock, he mutters. God damn it. He searches the bruises very carefully with his deft, intelligent fingers. His hands are exquisitely sensitive. They could find the smallest scratch, the least swelling, any point of extra heat. This is not deduction. This is diagnosis. His hands have the wisdom of years and long practice. This is what he does. The ribs are not quite cracked. The pectoral's a little torn. That cut may need restitching, but, oh, the beautiful, slender lines of him. John's eyes sting with the loveliness of Sherlock's long body, its clear, subtle musculature, its elegant bones. Where the skin's not bruised, it's so pale it moves him to tears. With a strange admixture of lust and care, he puts his mouth to each injury, and even this is diagnostic, as if he'd feel with his lips the swelling or heat of inflammation, taste any trace of blood, smell the taint of infection. Sherlock leans his head against John's hair, kisses it, mouths against it. I missed you, so horribly. But I couldn't come back. I wanted to. He's got his arms around John as if they're too heavy to put anywhere else. John's will to care for him flares abruptly, laser-like, intense and focused as a gun sight. He leans back, scans Sherlock's face. Are you hurt anywhere else? When did you eat last? Have you slept? Sherlock clears his throat, he almost smiles, and his voice regains a shade of its baritone resonance. Mrs. Hudson was here when I got back. She insisted on fussing over me. You know the way she is. Really, quite annoying. John half laughs at the touch of that familiar arch tone. He takes Sherlock's face in his hands, searches it once more. You sure you're all right? Adding, you thoughtless prick. Sherlock smiles, and his arms seem to have strength again, for he pulls John close, finds his sensitive, finely drawn lips, and kisses him. The kiss is tentative and uncertain, hesitant with apology. For John, there is no difference between forgiveness and desire. They just happen in different places. Forgiveness moves in his chest, swells, and melts the walls of his heart like the mud bricks of an ancient city sloughing away in rain. It flows down through his belly where desire waits, and, watered, blooms. He moves in close, between those long legs, and presses himself to Sherlock's cool, bare torso. The detective freezes, hitches a breath, and begins quietly to weep against his neck. John has never even imagined such a thing. It's like a natural phenomenon. It's almost more astonishing than seeing him again. As the humidity of tears gathers in the crook of his neck, he feels not pity, but a profound, soaring joy, for somehow the tears prove Sherlock's truly back and truly done. He cups a hand over the damp forehead, lifts Sherlock's face. It's wrought and crumpled as a child's. His eyes are swimming, grayer and sadder than the Thames. John presses his lips to them, left, right, and the tears taste like seawater from a copper pipe. John kisses his forehead, slight mineral tang of sweat. He draws his lips down the pallid cheeks, parchment smooth and damp, finds his mouth again, presses it open, and searches its changeable liquid contours with his tongue. Sherlock smells like London. He smells like city streets, like clean sidewalks after rain. And he tastes, yes, he tastes like a river. Rich and clean and vegetal, like wet leaves by a riverside. He realizes that Sherlock has roused under him, is kissing him back, is looking into his face with a shade of the fierce awareness John remembers. His kisses are more knowing now, more expressive, as if all that intelligence were coming present in his lips, as if John could breathe in his brilliance. And now those beautiful long-fingered hands are up under John's shirt, slipping the buttons, finding his chest, and they seem to know what they're doing because all they're doing is feeling, and not even Sherlock needs to think about that. John pulls back, looks into his face, that lovely face, and there is the man he knew. The blue-gray eyes lit with perception, now tinged a little hazel with desire. The dark circle around the iris, that hawk-like focus, the same strong lines, the same mouth, half Cupid's bow and half petulance, partly open now, a small, keen glint of teeth. John gives him his lips and lets him bite them just a little, for pain is the edge of pleasure, and fighters love that line. Sherlock is pulling at him, kissing him to bruising, a low, unthinking growl in the back of his throat. The leftover pain in his body has shaded into urgency, There's an almost clawing hunger in his touch, a small desperation and a ferocity. His hands move over John, claiming every place they touch, and their mouths contend together, a soft, messy struggle of lips and tongue and barest edge of teeth. He wrestles against John, clutches him close, striving against the walls of his body as if he'd break in or wash them away with the heat of his mouth. "Take it easy," John breathes. "You're going to hurt yourself. Or me." He braces himself up off the bruises. He unclenches those sculptor's hands, kisses calm into them, lays them on his own shoulders. With absolute care, he moves down the sleek stretch of ivory body. He traces a path between the bruises, over nipples soft as butter that rise under his lips. He opens Sherlock's trousers. There's a bruise on one hip. He sets his palm over it protectively. He doesn't let himself press or burrow until he gets to the almost startling darkness of the hair at Sherlock's groin. He breathes him in, the musky warmth, the smell of loam. He reaches in for the moist, earthy weight of his cock and gathers it up, testes and all. It's not quite hard. A large, tender handful, John cups, until the erection unfurls and slips free and stretches up against Sherlock's belly. John loves to use his hands in bed. Hands are strong and knowing. Hands make contact with the world, learning and moving and manipulating it. And John's hands are wise and loving and full of desire. Holding another man's cock in his hand moves him. Sherlock's graceful, weighty length makes his palm ache with lust. Everything under a hand is an object to be used or understood, learned or hurt or healed or treasured, as he treasures Sherlock now. Sherlock is watching him with a kind of wonder, a species of awe, fingers against John's face, tracing the edge of his lips with a thumb. He kisses them, upper, lower, pressing hard, slight scrape of teeth. Then, suddenly eager, he kicks his shoes off, pushes his trousers down, wraps his bare legs around John's chest, and pulls him in close between them. With a quick breath of laughter, John kisses his belly, then nuzzles his penis, rosy against that pale skin. He presses his lips step by step up its length, testing its hardness, feeling it quiver against his mouth. He slides the tip of his tongue beneath the foreskin. It tastes of seawater and cedar and copper coins. The silk of that skin slides under his lips as he moves his mouth down. The head slips over his tongue as he fills his mouth with it. To open his throat and let it in is easy. It's like breathing. It's like swallowing something good. When it slides out, he draws his lips along it firmly because it's delicious, and his mouth's watering, and he doesn't want to lose a drop. He feels fierce and hungry. It's hard to keep his teeth off. There's pre-cum salty on the back of his tongue, and when he swallows against the glands, Sherlock gasps and groans, and his dark, deep voice thrums in John's throat. He looks up along that narrow body, that shallow, gleaming belly, to where Sherlock's head is tipped back. He gazes, mouthful, at the gorgeous reach of that long white neck, sculpted cheekbones shining through black hair, snow on a raven's wing. John has his own cock out now, gripping it hard, two fingers tight behind the corona to keep himself from coming. The blood surges toward his fingers with every stroke of his mouth on Sherlock. His cock fights against his fist. Sherlock has a hand on the back of his neck and is thrusting as if he wants to feel John's teeth. When at last he comes, he cries out a harsh peregrine call and pulls hard at John's head. John has to brace his hands against the white thighs to keep from choking. But he holds his own, takes control of it, brings it down slowly, until there's nothing but quick jerks against his palate and spasms kicking now and then in the long muscles of Sherlock's thighs. The hunger takes John over. He pulls himself up to press his cock in the slippery groove by Sherlock's hip, forgetting to be careful of the bruise. Sherlock doesn't wince, not even when he hauls John's body up against him harder, legs still wrapped around him. John presses and slides and ruts in the sweat and the saliva and the cum on Sherlock's belly. He's kissing a stretch of neck, mouthing the taut muscle, biting at his shoulder. He tastes blood. Under the collarbone, one stitch has ripped, and he should be sorry, but now's not the time. Later. He's torn it. He can fix it. Now there's only the heat and the wetness and the straining against lean flanks. His own orgasm is not the usual surging clench, but a heady dissolution, a sudden and utter loosening, an abrupt flood that laces the air with a pungent smell of riverbank and brine. Sherlock pulls him the rest of the way to the sofa and holds him hard. He keeps his legs wrapped tight, hands in John's hair, kissing his face over and over. It is a claiming, a homecoming, and a restoration. He smiles at John, a free, wholehearted smile touched with triumph. The room is quiet. The fight's over. The battleground is empty. The days and the distance done and gone. John is here, finally here in the perfect place, in the perfect present. Sherlock lies against him, heavy and undeniable, and the world is real again. This is his time. This is his place. It is 9:15 in Baker Street, and they're home.